This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing from WNYC Radio. Ask actor Stacy Keach's loyal fans why they love him, and they'll point to a dozen different roles. He's played Richard III, King Lear, Hamlet, Falstaff, and Willie Loman.
The trouble is, Linda, people don't seem to take to me.
Keach has played captains and kings, pugilists, and pub crawlers.
You son of a...
But before you typecast him as strictly drama, note Stacy Keach's role as Sergeant Stadenko in Cheech and Chong's Up in Smoke, or as the president of Duff Beer in The Simpsons.
Take a hike, Duff Man. You're a disgrace to the unitard.
And I know I'll never forget his cameo on 30 Rock for its Couchtown commercials.
When did we get so soft? You know what this country used to sit on?
Logs, girders, poles. Being comfortable? That's not what America's all about.
The great thespian Keach literally spit into the camera. For me, it was one of the show's funniest bits ever. Keach is perhaps best known as the irresistible, hot-headed, fedora-wearing detective, Mike Hammer.
Are you for hire?
No, not at the moment.
My money's too dirty?
I've already got a client.
A lesser performer might have found himself with limited offers after what was Keach's longest-running job. Not so for the 71-year-old actor. His key to career longevity is simple. He says, quote, "You need television and movies to make a living, but you'll be taken more seriously if you are stage-worthy. Stage-worthy in Chicago and Washington, but especially New York." New York audiences saw Keach most recently on Broadway in John Robin Bates's play Other Desert Cities. Two generations of a Southern California family gather at Christmas and find themselves reliving a painful family secret. Keach played the conservative patriarch, and for him, it was familiar territory.
My dad and my mom and dad were very conservative, and every Easter, every Christmas, we would take trips to Palm Springs, the Shadow Mountain Country Club in Palm Desert, where they had water slides, the very first water slide. We'd spend a lot of time down there with a lot of conservative people in our business, you know, Republican, you know. So that was an environment that I was very familiar with.
What's it like for you now to work with younger actors who are very much of today? Do you find that the good ones operate the same way, or are they different?
They're different. They're very different.
In what way?
Well, for example, we had Justin Kirk came in for Tommy Sadowski to play Trip, the young, you know. And he's an actor that is, you know, wow, you know, I mean, every moment is something different. I mean, there's no consistency in terms. The only thing that was consistent was inconsistency.
Right.
You never knew what was going to come, you know. I kind of like that. Mm-hmm. I don't mind it. I mean, you know, I mean, as a younger actor, I probably would have gone nuts. I wouldn't have been able to deal with that because, I, you know.
You know, relied on a pattern of some kind.
Well, that's right. But I like that. I like spontaneity. I like flexibility. And I think that, you know,
Well, you've also learned how to handle it.
Well, that's it.
Keach's philosophy about acting has changed over the years.
I think in my early days, I started pretty much as, you know, from the outside and tried to get a fix on what the character looked like and then perhaps what he sounded like after that. But mainly it's look. I think, you know, that's when I, you know, and I, it wasn't the best way to start. I mean, I think it's better to start inside and work out if you can. And I, in later years, I've done that more and more. But I just finished a picture with Alexander Payne called Nebraska, where he called me and he said, I was playing the bad guy in this, and he said, your teeth are too good. So the whole character became centralized in terms of, you know, what I was in here, you know, and they made these snarly teeth for me, and it was great, you know, and it sort of gave me a feeling, and I would look at myself in the mirror and make, you know, facial expressions, and that sort of gave me the feeling of where this guy was coming from, you know. But it varies. I mean, if you're playing, like I was just down in Washington, I'm going to do Falstaff again next year, and, you know, he's this big, fat, corpulent guy, and interestingly enough, even with all the physical manifestations of that character, you got to go inside. I mean, that's, you know, and when
it's not enough just to play the look.
No, not at all. Not at all. When I first did it, it was back in 1968, I guess, 45 years ago.
You did what in 68?
Falstaff.
And you, did they put a suit on you?
Oh, huge, just big.
Yeah, you were a very lean guy.
I was, yeah. You know, and I had to wear this big fat suit.
Yeah.
Theoni Aldridge designed his leather costume for me.
And what did they do back then in terms of your face when you're lean?
Whiskers.
Oh, I see.
Eyebrows.
Right.
Had a wig, of course, and a bulbous nose. And I was shooting a picture in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, end of the road, with James Earl Jones and Harris Yulin. I was shooting during the day and had to go on stage in the park at night. So I'd get in the car at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. We'd drive down the Taconic. And I'd be making up in the car in the front seat as we...
You were shooting a movie with Harris Yulin and James Earl Jones in the Berkshires, and you would drive down to Central Park?
Yeah.
To do 8 shows?
The
park isn't 8 shows. Yeah, the park is 5 shows right on the weekend.
Well, I guess so. Yeah, it was
Thursday, Friday, 2
matinees. They didn't do matinees. But nevertheless, it was an experience. I mean, you know, to be making up in the car and looking, you know, and buses would come up beside me and I'd be, you know, looking at it, look at, you know, what this crazy guy doing there. But it was an experience. But anyway, I went and saw Orson Welles do Chimes at Midnight. What he did in that film, I thought it was a great performance. He personalized that guy so much. It was like he didn't put any spin on it at all. He was just talking right from his heart. I mean, it was right, you know, he was really centered on that guy. And I thought to myself, that's the key. I mean, you got to find the equivalent of that for you when you get in there and when you get inside the fat suit, you're going to have to find the personalization of that, you know.
What was it about you?
I was way too young when I played him.
Well, I was going to say, what was it about you that back then when you were this athletic, lean, leading man in the movie business, you wanted to put a fat suit on. Why were you running into it? Why were you diving into a fat suit?
Well, because I, you know,
you wanted great parts.
Exactly. And that is one of the, probably, I think, of all of Shakespeare's characters, I think it's probably one of the, you know, that and Hamlet are probably the two greatest, better than Lear, I think. I mean, it's a greater part. It's more, there's much more going on with Falstaff, I think.
And you're going to do it again.
Yeah.
So you did Falstaff the first time when?
68. 68 in the park. Oh, yeah, it makes me feel very young.
45 years later.
45 years later.
You're going to play Falstaff.
And I won't have to wear padding this time. No, I'm teasing
you. Well, who are you doing it for?
Michael Kahn at the Shakespeare Theater in Washington, D.C.
Oh, you're going to do D.C.
Yeah. We're going to do both parts. We're going to do part one and part two. One of the great experiences of my life was doing those plays together in the park. We started at 10 o'clock at night, and we did part one and then part two. And as the dawn came up in at the end of the evening, it was the early morning, it was just when Falstaff was being deposed by Prince Hal, played by Sam Waterston.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
What's a role that you've played, film or television or stage, that was an extraordinarily difficult, if not even painful? And I don't mean the events around the show. I don't mean the producer was a bastard. I mean the playing the part itself was extraordinarily
Scottish
difficult.
The Scottish play.
Where'd you do that?
I did that in Washington as well. Right. Yeah.
How long ago?
That was about 12 years ago.
How old are you now?
I'll be 72 in June.
So you did it when you were 60 years old, you played
something like that, yeah. I used to say that, you know, you work your butt off playing that part, and the woman gets all the glory, you know, and she takes all the thunder, you know. It's an amazing play. I mean, it's a beautifully written play, and it's very poetic, and it's got some wonderful ideas in it, but the guy is not the sympathetic.
No.
You have to give up trying to make people feel sorry for you.
That's a very good point you make, because that's probably a flaw that I've had in a lot of what I've done.
Well, we all do
is try to make them sympathetic.
Well, we want.
And when I didn't, I think it worked better. You know, other roles I played, when I just gave up on that. So that was a tough role for you. Why?
It was. Well, because, again, trying to make them sympathetic. Wrong, bad choice, you know. And I stole a bit from Olivier when the ghost appears, he jumped on the banquet table and he jumped on top of the table with and I thought, well, that's, you might as well, if you're going to steal, steal from the best, go for
the big
it.
Big O.
And then, and it worked. That worked. And from that point on, you know, once I sort of felt like I was, you know, I was, the madness liberated me in a way. It liberated me.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah. Then it was,
the more unglued you are, the
better.
The choices just come flying out of you sometimes. It's like a vending machine sometimes if you're in that state.
That's right. Yeah.
You grew up where?
I grew up in Southern California.
And your dad was in the business?
Dad was in the business.
What did he do?
He was an actor, director, producer. He did a show, a radio show, called Tales of the Texas Rangers with Joel McRae. And that, when I was 12 years old, he used to take me down to NBC Studios, and I would watch these actors do their thing. It was a live radio broadcast with all the Foley and the sound effects and the horses and, you know.
Right.
And that was magic for me. And radio was how I sort of got introduced.
And your dad worked in radio?
Yeah.
That was his thing?
That was his thing. He was also an actor. He played small parts. I remember he used to come home after doing a guest shot on Tales of the Lone Ranger or, what was the other, Dragnet.
Mm-hmm.
Get Smart was a show that he did.
And was your mom in the business?
No, but when she was at Northwestern, that's where she met my dad. And they were at Northwestern together. And she was an actress at that time. But. Uh-huh. But she never pursued it professionally. Yeah,
what did he say to you? What was his program with you, so to speak, in terms of your career? Did he want you to do this?
No. He didn't. Absolutely not. He said, no, acting is not something you should do. He wanted me to be a lawyer. And he wanted my brother to be a doctor. He said, you know, this business is too fraught with insecurity.
Did you almost do that? Did you think about it?
Well, you know what? When I started acting in high school, junior high school, was doing plays, and every time I would get a part in a play, my dad would get very excited. He would get very animated, and he wanted to show me. Like, for example, I was doing the stage manager in our town in high school, and he would come in, and it was his favorite play. And he showed me, he said, no, when you're describing that, he said, you describe that big butternut tree. You've got to see that tree. And when you're working in the drugstore and you're getting ice cream out of the ice cream box, you've got to reach your hand way down in there and pull it. I mean, he was so animated. He came
specific.
Alive. Very specific and very much alive. So all of his BS about not do this, you're not going to do this, you're going to be a lawyer, you know.
Was it, you think, because he wasn't as successful as he wanted to be, that he wanted you more to be a success? Because that's very common. That's what I experienced with my dad. My dad had no money. He was a school teacher. He was constantly under the gun and about money. It was tormented him. And I think when he looked at me, he was like, it's less about what you want to be than it is about being successful at something.
I think our dad.
Did he drive? Yeah. Did he drive you in that direction?
Absolutely.
So when you wound up, did he live long enough to see you succeed?
Yes. Yeah.
And what did he?
Well, then that was the good part.
Then you're a genius.
Yeah. Well, then it was a good thing. Yeah. Because it wasn't until I got to Berkeley and I started. You know, I was given an edict. You're not going to be in any plays. First year, as a freshman. I was studying political science and economics. I mean, that was it. I was going to
do the same thing.
You know, and that was, you know,
And they don't think you're worthy in your first year.
No.
They want you to wait.
That's right. So at the end of the first year, I got a play. I finally, you know, I got through the first year, and he said, okay, if you want to do a play, you can do a play. So I did a play, and that was it. It was a play called To Learn to Love. It was written by one of the professors, and it was about these Navy guys, and it was a big hit on campus. The professor cast me the next semester as De Flores in The Changeling, a Jacobean play written by Thomas Middleton. Middleton and Rowley, great, great piece. Sort of a Richard III type of character, and I had, you know, success with that. And my parents came and saw me, and they said, well, I guess, you know, you may have some talent, so maybe if this is what you want to do, we'll support you. So they came
around.
Knowing
you had some talent, at least they thought you're on to something.
Yeah, and I loved it. I mean, I couldn't stand economics and political science, man. I was terrible.
This was at USC?
No, Berkeley.
At Berkeley. So you're up in Berkeley.
Yeah.
And you finished. You went all 4 years there.
Yeah, I went 4 years.
And you got a degree in drama.
I got a degree in drama and English, yeah.
And then what did you do after that?
Then I went to Yale Drama School for a year.
What was the program there? Was it longer than a year, or you finished the whole thing in a year?
No, it was a 3-year program. I only stayed a year. I didn't like it at all.
Why?
Well, in those days, Constance Welsh was the acting teacher, and she was pretty much very much old school. They didn't know in those days whether they were training people for the academic theater or for the professional theater, to be teachers or to be professional.
Big distinction.
big distinction. And it was, you know, learning all these phonetic signs and symbols. And, I mean, this had nothing to do with what I was interested in. And I had just, I had done 2 summers at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival between my junior and senior year and between my senior year and my first year at Yale. And played some pretty good part, Henry V and Mercutio and Verona. And sort of, I was getting my feet wet with Shakespeare. And these big, wonderful
parts.
Was
Shakespeare a part of your childhood and your upbringing?
No.
I mean, why are you so, you're pretty much steeped in Shakespeare in your early stage career. Why? This was just your own passion.
Oregon Shakespeare Festival.
That's was responsible for it.
Yeah. That's
you went there and you were at home.
That's right. That's where it started. That's where it started. And then when I came back east, I was at Yale, and I wasn't crazy about Yale.
No more phonetic symbols.
Right. No more, and Joe.
After that year, where'd you, Joe found you?
Joe Papp, yeah, and I'm well.
And thanks to Oregon Shakespeare Festival, you were ready.
Yeah, I think so.
Pretty much.
And Henry Hughes, he was a drama critic for the Saturday Review, wrote a nice review of me doing Henry V. Joe had read that, and when I got to Yale, I called the New York Shakespeare Festival, wanted to audition. He said, come on down. So I went, and I met Joe Papp and in this smoke-filled office in, here in Manhattan. I sat down, and he said, okay, what are you going to do for me? I said, well, I'll do a little piece from Henry V, Upon the King. And I started reading. Upon the King, let us our lives. That's it. You know, are you a member of Equity? I said, no. I said, well, you're going to be. You're going to play Marcellus in my production of Hamlet this summer. Julie Harris is going to be playing Ophelia. Alfred Ryder is going to be playing Hamlet. We'll see you this summer. That was it. I walked out there. I was floating on air.
Sure.
I mean, that was it, you know. And then summer of 1964. And that
did
summer.
Did you move to New York?
Yeah, for that summer I did, yeah. And then I went to England after that on a Fulbright scholarship to the London Academy of Music and Dramatic Art.
For what?
To study for a year.
Well, why did you stop? Now you've got, I mean, I wonder if this is the beginning of a pattern where you get the hot hand here and Joe Papp wants you.
Yeah.
And then you say, okay, hold on, fellas, I got to go over to London for a year.
Well, that's it. And he was not happy about that, Joe. And interestingly enough, he was also on, I didn't realize this, it was just a coincidence. He was on the screening committee for the Fulbright guys. And when I came in, he said, what are you here for? And I said, I'm auditioning for, you know, he said, don't do Upon the King again. I've seen it. You know, do something else. And
he was tough.
And he was tough. And I did not, I was not given a Fulbright. I was chosen as an alternate. I was really depressed.
That summer, so you went to Lambda.
That summer, I got a note from the Fulbright Commission saying, the guy who was supposed to go dropped out, so you're in. So
you made it by the skin of your teeth.
That's it. Yeah.
Now, why Lambda? Were you going to train for the musical theater?
For classical theater.
Right, for classical theater.
Yeah.
And you were there for a year?
I was there for a year.
What did you benefit from that?
Well, first of all, the exposure to the English theater in that year was unbelievable.
It's incomparable.
Unbelievable. And I got to see, I saw Olivier do not only Othello, I saw him do The Master Builder, saw his production that he directed of the Crucible. It was an amazing year.
Were you ever tempted to stay there? Did you feel you belonged there?
No. Americans doing classical theater still is looked on a little bit askance by the English. I mean, you know, just like we don't, you know.
I don't want them to touch Williams either.
Exactly.
Right.
It's the same deal, you know.
So you finished there and you came right home.
I came back. Then I came to Lincoln Center and I auditioned for Jules Irving and Herbert Blau, who were just coming from the Actors Workshop in San Francisco, where when I had been a student at Berkeley, I knew all those actors, and I'd gone to see a lot of their shows, and a lot of those actors were also at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. Liz Huddle, Robert Phelan, Dan Solomon, who's now, of course, one of our best directors. Mm-hmm. This was the company. So I went in, I auditioned. They said, come on in. You're in the company. So I was married at the time.
Why'd you do that?
I know. Well, that was a mistake. But we moved to New York, and I spent that first year. Danton's Death, The Country Wife, The Condemned of Altona by Jean-Paul Sartre, and The Caucasian Chalk Circle. Not what you would call a banner, you know, commercial season.
Yeah.
And they just got murdered. These guys, they just got, well, because they came in thinking they were going to change the New York theater. Wrong.
Who was your first wife?
Her name was Catherine Baker, and she was...
Where'd you meet her?
In Berkeley.
At the airport while you were going from one location to the other?
No, not quite. But anyway, but she was my college sweetheart. Yeah.
She was your college sweetheart.
Yeah.
And I'm going to ask you this as we go down the road here for each of your wives. What do you think she loved about you?
Oh, God.
Did she love that life you were living? Did she love your passion and your commitment to acting?
I have no idea.
You'd have to ask her.
You'd have to ask her, yeah. I don't know. I really don't. Oh, God.
But did you feel at that time that you had an intensity about you as an actor that was very, very attractive to other people?
Well,
could you feel that?
I wasn't.
You're saying you weren't a ladies' man?
Well, I was and I wasn't. I mean, I definitely.
No, I love that. I love somebody who says, I was and I wasn't.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Well, I love the lady. I've always loved ladies, you know.
Yeah.
But there's a misogynistic element in my character that I think I have to, you know, deal
about
with.
Trust.
Trust? If I love somebody, and you know, I'm trustworthy.
I'm in the same school. It's hard for me to trust people. It's hard.
Hard.
So these guys from San Francisco come, and they're going to change the New York theater, and they kind of flop. Then what happens?
And then I went back to my roots at Yale. Nicholas Zacharopoulos was in Williamstown.
Yeah.
And he said, come on up to Williamstown and be with me for the summer.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that was it. I mean, I loved doing that. I went up there and had a great, great summer. And one of my fellow students at Yale had this play that he had, that a very good friend of his at Berkeley had written. Barbara Garson was her name, and the play was called McBird, a play about Lyndon Johnson as the Scottish guy. And it was suggesting that he was responsible for the assassination of John F. Kennedy.
Right. The play says that.
Yeah. That's what it was. And it was a great cast. Bill Devane played
JFK?
Bobby Kennedy. Paul Heck played JFK. And it was wonderful. We did it at the Village Gate. We thought we were going to get shut down. We thought the government was going to come in and say we were seditious.
What year?
66.
So Johnson's in the height of his...
Absolutely. We thought we were going to shut down. We thought it was over.
The FBI is coming. The ushers are in the FBI.
Yes. Nothing.
Nothing.
Not a thing.
It's a hit.
It's a big hit.
Yeah.
And that's what really got me going.
What did you think about the context? Because I'm a bit of an assassination buff myself. This is the 50th anniversary this November.
I know.
This year is the 50th anniversary of Kennedy's assassination, which I still don't think we know the truth about.
I don't either.
What did you think about when you did the play? Was it...
Well, I wasn't...
Did it add up?
Not really.
Yeah.
No. But the suggestion that he was somehow involved or knew what was going on was very palpable.
He didn't mind that it happened.
No. The audience believed it. I mean, they actually, put it this way, I don't know if they believed that it was true, but they certainly accepted the premise that it was worth dramatizing.
There was something there.
Yeah.
And that ran for how long?
It ran for a couple of years. I stayed in it for about 9 months. And then,
what's the longest run you've ever done as an actor on stage?
About 9 months.
That was it?
Well, no. Other Desert Cities ran for about almost a year, I think. That's about it for me.
Stacy Keach's runs are sometimes limited by his desire to be near his family. He and his wife Malgosia, a native of Poland, lived in a suburb of Warsaw for several years when their children were teenagers. Stacy says he commuted from Warsaw to wherever there was work. When he was doing the TV show Prison Break, he was lucky there was a direct flight between Warsaw and Chicago. Coming up, Stacy Keach talks about working with director John Huston.
I said, well, why did you do that? How did you come up with this idea? And he said, the devil made me do it.
This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. This is Here's the Thing from WNYC. Many people don't understand how an actor can perform in the same play night after night for months. The truth is, it never gets boring. It's like skiing a black diamond run for me to go all the way down and not fall. And I fall every night.
Yeah.
One show I did recently, a few years back, I did give myself a diploma for having a perfect show.
Right, right.
I said every word as
right.
Because you and I both know that when you get to that level where you're at, you know when you don't say the words right.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know the play backwards and forwards. You know
sure.
every cue.
Right.
You might not say it that way in real time.
No.
So I came off stage, and I said to myself, the stage managers were there and everybody and the prop people, and I came off stage and I said, well, there you have it.
There you have it.
I said, there it is,
yeah.
The perfect show.
Ah.
I said, every line as written, the way I wanted to say it and with the feeling I wanted, and I just really, really skied the run right to the bottom. That's happened to me once in my
right.
career.
Wow.
And every other time I missed a little. I didn't,
oh, yeah, yeah,
I
yeah.
didn't, I wasn't connected to the speech.
Well, I know exactly what you're saying.
What's the role you've been the most connected to?
Well, I did Hamlet three times mm-hmm. to try to get it right. I never did. I never got
it. Why do you say that?
Three different productions.
What was the first one?
Long Wharf Theater. Arvin Brown directed it.
And what year?
Let me see if I can remember the year. It had to be 70. It had to be somewhere in the, I think it was 70.
You're a young man. 70.
Oh, yeah. I was actually... Well, they say Hamlet's 30, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I was about 30 when I did it, yeah. Mm-hmm. And
so you were up in New Haven.
I was up in New Haven. And, you know, the first time you play that part, I was so intimidated by the fact of all the other actors who had played it. And, you know, it's intimidating. I mean, mm-hmm. you know,
This is your Hamlet.
That's right.
It becomes your Hamlet.
And most of the time I was concerned about getting the lines right and getting, you know, just getting the moves right, just getting it, just putting it all together and then trying to figure it out, which is what I did. And then the next year, I mean, that summer, Joe Papp came and saw it and he said, come into the park and we'll do it a different production, totally different production, different director, which was very hard for me to give up Arvin Brown. And Gerald Friedman, who I'd worked with on Big Bird, was asked to direct it.
Were you happy with the new cast?
Well, it was a fantastic cast. I mean, it was James Earl Jones.
He was the one with Colleen?
Yeah.
Okay.
With Colleen, yeah. Yeah. And I got closer to it. I felt, you know, I never had the perfect show, but I got closer to it. And then...
So that was right after New Haven?
Right after.
And then what?
2 years later, Mark Taper Forum in Los Angeles. Totally different production. Gordon Davidson directing. And Harris Yulin playing Claudius. I had one night where I got close, where I really got close. And then I don't know what happened. Something, I think it was in the very last scene. I think the hardest thing about Hamlet is after that amazing duel in the last act, but when he dies, you know, is not to be caught breathing on stage. That's the hardest, one of the hardest things to do, I think, in that particular play. I mean, anyway. But
that was your third and final
show.
One.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, the perfect show is elusive. It's the fact that you found. I think one night I was doing Death Trap. I remember.
Who'd you do it with?
The actors that I worked with. I can't remember their names. This is terrible, terrible. Darren. I remember his first name was Darren.
So they weren't well-known people.
Oh, yeah. But, I mean, I love that play. Do you know that?
Oh, I mean, I saw Brian Bedford do it at the Kennedy Center when I was in college.
Oh, wow.
Both of them wanted to do Death Trap because
it's a great piece.
It's a great summer stock play, too. I love Schaffer.
Yeah. I did.
Oh, it was Ira Levin.
Yeah, it was Levin. Ira Levin.
Right.
I get confused, too.
It wasn't Tony Schaffer. It was Ira Levin.
Right. I did a Tony Schaffer play with Sleuth.
Yeah,
which
of course.
Was the only play.
That's why I confused the two.
Yeah, that's very similar.
You did Sleuth.
Yeah.
Who'd you do that with?
Maxwell Coffey.
Good for you.
Yeah.
He's a buddy of mine.
Yeah, we're going to be...
Him and Juliet Mills.
We'll be together tomorrow night. We became very dear friends on Sleuth. And
I love him.
Yeah, he's great. And Juliet is the godmother of my daughter, Carolina.
How many kids do you have?
Two.
And you have two girls, a boy and a girl?
Boy and a girl.
So your son is how old?
24, and he's a student at NYU, studying corporate communications and international business relations.
And his mom is wife number what?
Four.
Your current wife.
Yeah.
So your current
no
wife.
No children by any other.
No children. You did it. You handled that beautifully. Oh, my God. So you got the marriage right then had the family.
That's right.
Boy, you clever bastard. So three marriages. What was the longest of the other three?
2 years.
So the longest.
Yeah. Okay, 2 years. Yeah, that's right.
The longest of the other three. Let's really round it off here. It was 2.5 years.
Yeah.
You think you're tough to be married to?
I do.
You do.
I know I am.
Because do you think it's your work, though? Do you think
business.
Your dedication to this? I had a woman say to me once, a very famous woman, that her husband was a famous actor, and he did a television series. This is many years ago.
Right.
And she said to me, he'd go to work, and he was a father on the show.
Right.
And she said, and he gave everything he had on camera. He said he came home, he had nothing for his own children.
Oh, that's too bad.
He came home, locked himself in his room, had a drink in his hand, had the TV on. He was just... Like we said, he was just emptied out.
Right. That's sad.
Now, what changed when you met wife number four?
Well,
I only mention these things not to be, prying. I'm just saying, for a man of passion, when you get it right, what was the difference? What happened? What changed?
Somebody who understood me, I think, really understood it.
Gave you your space.
Gave me my space.
Let you be who you are.
Absolutely.
Which is a nut job.
Really. And that's critical. And
sometimes.
Let's face it. Well, no. But
passionate.
But you and I are, our lives are very active. We spend a lot of time doing things that are not family related necessarily.
Right.
You know?
What's something you think you missed other than parenthood, other than maybe more time with your family, other than having the opportunity at least to make a better go of it with your previous wives, because I'm divorced as well, all that kind of stuff. What's something you think that you would love to have done with your life that you missed because of this work? Because I have an answer for myself, but what's yours?
I would have been more of an adventurer, more of an explorer, more of an outdoors kind of guy. I would have, taken
going,
off and gone
seeing,
expeditions.
Hiking, doing,
Yes.
I agree.
I didn't do it.
Mine was education. I would have gone back to school. And so now I sit back and I go, whenever I speak at schools now, I say to people, because I'm teaching at NYU this spring, I say, how many people here are graduating now? And, maybe like a quarter of them raised their hands in this lecture I gave to about 100 kids. Mm. And I said, how many of you, how many of you are juniors? So another quarter of them raised. So the rest of them, half the kids were sophomores and freshmen in the acting program.
Mm-hmm.
I said, do yourself a favor. I said, this is the only time of your life you can read.
Right.
And really on a dedicated, you're
good
here
for you.
To
good.
Read. I said, take lit courses, take history courses, read, because you're going to miss it.
I'm teaching acting this year.
Where?
I teach at George Mason University.
In D.C.?
Via Skype.
Wow. How does that go?
It's wonderful because I'm teaching kids how to audition, basically, both using material from the theater and from television and movie scripts. The camera's right there. They have to get up in front of a camera just like they do in an audition. So they do a scene for me. I give them a critique. They go back, they work on it for a week, they come back and they show it to me again. I can teach this course from Poland, from Los Angeles, from New York.
Have you taught acting before?
Yes.
Where?
When I went back to Yale as an actor-performer, an actor-teacher, many years ago, when right after McBird, when Brustein first came into Yale. I taught at Yale for a year while I was a member of the company. And I've taught master classes here and there.
Do you like teaching?
I love it.
You do?
I do. And I, my kids, one of the things that they read. They have to read. They have to read four plays and write a report. They have to have quizzes on, not just the things that they read in terms of literature or dramaturgy. And I've discovered an acting book that I just think is fantastic called The Actor's Target, The Actor and the Target by Declan Donovan. He's an English guy. It's a fabulous book.
Why is it fabulous?
Well, because it sort of reinterprets the whole notion of actioning and it takes Stanislavski's ideas. He has his own set of terms, his own terminology, which is refreshing in a way because it's not the same old stuff that we've been hearing for years and years. But I think reading is critical. And I know when I first got there, I was told by the university, you don't have to, you don't have to assign things for them to read. You can just have them read the material that they're working on in terms of the scenes that they're presenting. And I said, no. In the course of my career, I've run into a lot of guys who are illiterate. And it's not good. I think the more you know in terms of the more...
References.
Yeah.
It's like a scale.
Right.
There's only so many notes.
Right.
And you play them in different combinations, maybe.
What musical instrument do you play?
Never played one.
with your musical.
I wish I could sing, but I can't sing to save my life.
Nor can I.
You can't.
No, but I have a pretty good ear, and I'm musical. And I do play, and but
you play piano.
Yeah, yeah. But
you grew up that way.
Yeah,
that was okay. Great.
Yeah, yeah. I grew up. Yeah, and
who was responsible for that? Your mom or your dad?
My mom, basically, primarily. Yeah. You're going to practice or you're not going to take the car out. One of those things.
Threats.
And we tried to do that with our kids. It didn't work. And the screaming and yelling, and we gave in.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry I did. I think,
that's the way we are now. We don't want to do the heavy lifting.
I know.
Our parents were willing to be unpopular.
That's right.
Our parents were what I call the Captain Bly School.
Yeah, that's good.
I've got a job to do here.
Yeah.
I got to get this breadfruit back to England.
Yes.
And I don't care whether you like it or not.
I know.
Now our parents are all like, oh, please, don't look at me that way. Are you mad at me?
That's right.
And we shine our kids' asses all day long.
I know.
It's terrible. It's the end of the world, actually.
Well, I hope not.
I hope you're wrong.
So you were saying about teaching, though, that do what I found is that when I teach, I don't say this, but I think it may or may not be implied when I'm doing this, is that I can't make you a good actor. You know,
right.
I can make you a better actor maybe than when you came in.
Right.
If you have some ability, I can begin to point the way toward you what you might develop.
Right.
But you either got it or you don't.
That's right.
I really believe that.
I do too.
And a lot of people don't.
I
want to hear that.
Well, I know.
And in a degree-granting academic program, you'll see that a lot of people have the grades to go to the fine institution, and they're not necessarily the best actors.
No.
And I'll say to them, the people I've worked with, I'll say, well, why don't we tear out a couple seats here on the side of Elijah, and let's have you give me a class of 20 people or 24 people.
Right.
Let's have 3 or 4 kids who their cum and their academic credentials were okay. They were good. They weren't a complete bust. But you brought them in here not just for their benefit, but for the benefit of the other kids in the class who can see what good acting is in that kind of a embryonic phase. I find teaching acting, it's tough for that reason.
It is tough.
And you
really nailed what I was just going to say. I've got 20 kids, and maybe of those 20 kids, 4, could...
Yeah, that's what I get. That's about the number I get to. And Keach is indeed a good judge of talent. Henry Winkler was a student of his when he taught at Yale, and Keach said it was clear he would do something special. That was over 45 years ago. This is a man with stories, and he's finally put them down on paper. Stacy Keach has a memoir coming out this fall. All in All, An Actor's Life on and Off Stage will be published by Globe Pequot Press.
It's an ordeal. I mean, to write a memoir, and you're going to be doing this one of these days.
Why did you do it?
Well, I'm at that age, I feel like, I better get it down now, otherwise,
the truth,
yeah.
As I saw it.
Yeah, yeah. Get it down now, because, times are running out. And so I wanted to, and I have a lot of stories to tell, and I work with a lot of great people, including John Huston.
Talk about Huston. What was it like?
Oh, God. Well, I remember the first time I met him. He came to visit me on the set of Doc. We were shooting a Western in Spain with Faye Dunaway and Harris Yulin, and we were in this script, Fat City, written. It was a very popular book written by Leonard Gardner about boxing, and he came to see me personally on the set. I mean, to have John Huston visit me on the set of a movie, I mean, it was, and he was very gracious, and he said, "Stace, I've got a part for you, and I think you ought to take a look at this." And he treated me as if I was his son, right from the word go. I mean, he was so warm.
He welcomed you.
Yeah.
That's rare in the business.
Oh, yeah. But he had no pretenses about, I mean, he was larger than life. He didn't make any apologies for that. I mean, and he was an extraordinary, extraordinary human being. He loved to gamble.
I wonder what that was about.
Well, it's very interesting because I love to gamble too.
What's your game?
Well, with him it was backgammon.
Right.
We would play backgammon between scenes on
for
the
set. $100 a game?
No, dollar a point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, he just liked it for the fun.
Yeah, but
he wasn't a gambler trying to make money.
No, not with me. Now, but. But we went to the Cannes Film Festival a year later, and also we were in London together, and he would, he said, "Let's go to the casino." He loved, you know, he'd
go do a little gaming.
Yeah, a little gaming. Very good.
Yes.
Yeah, and he loved it. I don't know, what is it about gambling? It's the Dostoevsky thing. I mean, the challenge of, they say that people gamble to lose. They don't really gamble to win, or at least, you know, to experience what it's like to feel what it, you know, how to compensate for the feeling of loss. You know, I think there's something to that. I mean, that was, you know. Anyway,
I love the line someone told me that people gamble to find that if God favors them or not.
Ooh.
They want to know, does God favor me today?
Well, you know,
if I win, then that's my sign that God favored me.
I like that. I get on my iPhone and I there's a game called Bejeweled. It's a little bit like Angry Birds,
right?
You know? And I feel like if I can get it right, then God's looking good.
Yes,
you know?
Yes.
Yeah, I think
I'm complete.
Yeah. I love it. I mean, you know.
What was it like shooting the movie with Houston? What was he like as a director? Was he insightful for you? Did he help you?
Absolutely.
He was.
Oh, yeah. Well, he's an actor, first of
course.
All. You know, and he always wanted to give you your space. He said, there's only two directions, Days, a little more or a little less.
Hmm.
That was it. He never told me to, you know, try to, I mean, well, yes, he did once in a while. But he would let us block the scenes. Susan Terrell and I, God love her, he would say, go in there and you stage the scene the way you feel like it should be staged in a domestic scene in a kitchen or something like that. And we would go in there and we would stage the scene. We'd work out the moves.
There's a lot of trust to have in his actors.
Tremendous. Yeah. Tremendous. But he was right. He'd come in and look at it, and then he'd move things around a little bit, make a tweak here, a tweak there. And Conrad Hall, who was the cameraman, would come in and work with him. God love him. And that's the way he worked. And then, but the thing that really fascinated me about Houston was at the very end of the movie. I'll never forget. Jeff Bridges and I were sitting in this cafe, and it's the very last scene of the movie. And in the background, there were these people sitting at tables, smoke rising, and they were gambling, and they were playing cards, and they were talking to each other. And he said, all right, I want everybody in the background to just freeze. Just don't do anything. Freeze. And you could see the smoke rising up, so you knew it was not a freeze frame that was done technically by the editors. It was something that he directed. And I said, John, why did you do that? And he said, because when Billy Tully looks over there and sees nothing, he said, I just want there to be the feeling that God is intervening here in some way. I said, well, why did you do that? How did you come up with this idea? And he said, the devil made me do it.
Okay.
I mean, I was just, you know, off the wall kind of, you know, comments. But
How was his health then? Was he pretty lucid then? He wasn't really very sick then.
No, he wasn't.
He was pretty together then.
But he chain-smoked Monte Cristo number ones.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was always a box of cigars under his hand, and the backgammon set in the other hand.
Yeah. Wherever John Houston is, I want him to know that when the time comes for me and Stacy, we'll be more than ready for backgammon and cigars with him. Let me just say, as we finish here, that, you know, I wrote the foreword to your book because you occupy a very unique place. You know, what stands out to me is that you're so comfortable on stage, and that transmits. There's a telepathic signal you kind of send to the audience. I wrote this story. I said, you know, you enthrall people and you inspire people, whatever, but you welcome them at the same time. Because when someone's on stage and they're uncomfortable, you feel it.
Yeah.
And you are someone who your commitment, forget about your talent, because you are a immeasurably talented man.
Well, thank you.
But the companion with that is how committed you are. When you go and do something, you give it everything you have.
Well, so do you, sir.
And you are a great inspiration to me. When I saw you do other desert cities, I sat there and I looked at my friend and I go, look at that son of a bitch. Look how fucking fantastic he looks up on that stage. There's no place else he'd rather. And you had the audience right here.
Oh, thank you, Ali.
You're a treasure. Thanks for doing this with me.
I loved it. Thanks, man.
I'm Alec Baldwin. Here's the Thing comes from WNYC Radio.